This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the Forma podcast from the Circe Institute Podcast Network, a podcast about the intersection of classical thoughts and contemporary culture, and the audio companion to Forma Journal. I'm Heidi White, managing editor of Forma Journal, and as always, an avid enthusiast of interesting people doing wonderful things. So in this episode, I'll be talking with Josh Bales, a singer, songwriter, therapist, and priest. Josh, thank you so kindly for joining us today on the Forma podcast.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure, Heidi, and I'm really honored to be on your show.
Oh, well, thank you. Josh, a little bit about Josh for our listeners. Josh is equal parts singer-songwriter, Anglican priest, and mental health therapist in private practice. He holds an MDiv and MA in counseling from Reformed Theological Seminary, as well as a certificate in Anglican studies from Neshota House Theological Seminary. He is the senior fellow for music and art at the Colson Center. Josh's music has gained a following of fans from all walks of life after recording 4 diverse albums and touring for more than 15 years. His latest album is a second volume of hymns called Come Away from Rush and Hurry, released in 2018. Originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee, Josh now lives in Orlando, Florida, where he serves as canon priest at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke. So Josh, thank you for joining us on the Forma podcast. I'm so glad you're here. Is it okay if I just dive into the conversation?
Yes, please. Let's do it.
All right. Well, first, will you tell us just a little bit about your work? You're an Anglican priest, a musician, and a therapist. That's a lot of things. So tell our listeners about that. How did all that come about?
Yes. Well, even as you say those words, I'm feeling stressed right now. So that's probably... You know, honestly, I had no plan to do all three things. I just really loved all three things. Hmm. And I grew up in the church in the Bible Belt in Tennessee. And from an early age, I mean, this is perhaps a cliche, but it was true for me. I've always felt called to be in what they call full-time ministry in growing up. And So I sort of pursued that even going to seminary. But while that was happening, the music part of my life just kind of developed, and I kept writing and kept recording. And the therapy thing has been a part of my story because my mom was a therapist. So I grew up with, you know, random psychology books literally on the like coffee table in our living room, not your normal like magazines sitting on the coffee table, but like weird psychology books.
Good for your mom. Sure. She sounds awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's either really, really weird or very good. I don't know. But I'm sure that had a big role to play in like finally pursuing the actual therapy part of my work. So then the MDiv part of my seminary kind of took me further into ministry, and then the MA in counseling took me further into counseling work. So, and then I married a counselor. So okay. There's that too. There's always that.
But the streams come together.
The streams. Yeah. Well, that was probably the part B of my story, is how the three work together. And I feel like I've tried over the years to whittle it down to one of the three. And I think I've focused on one of the three parts at a single time in my life, and it's never worked out. Like, I've tried to put all my eggs in one basket, and I, for practical reasons or for just soul reasons, I didn't feel like it was what I should be doing. So here I am now. I'm at a wonderful church full time, but they embrace my work as a therapist and as a musician. And so, like, I get a certain number of weeks to travel a year. Hmm. And then I see all of my private practice counseling folks in my office as a priest. So it just, like, I feel so blessed. I cannot even describe the fun of getting to do all three things. And of course, they're not all happening at once. Like,
right.
You know, we were talking a little earlier, this week is a heavy church week because we're handling a pastoral crisis with the coronavirus. But yeah, sometimes there'll be these golden weeks where I see clients, I get to celebrate the Eucharist at noonday mass or something. And then I leave on Thursday for a music trip. And it's like, perfect. that's my amazing. Soul is alive. Yeah.
So Josh, I heard you speak late last year at an event in Colorado Springs at St. George's Anglican Church, and you spoke about music and mental health, and you addressed your work as a priest as well. The talk was excellent, just inspiring and wise and warm-hearted. And I really noticed your heart for the people of God just shone that night. And to address what you just said, I'm really interested, and I'd love to talk more about what you just said. It's kind of personal for me because, like you, I do a lot of things. I'm a wife and a mom. I'm the managing editor of Forma Journal. I host this podcast. I also do another weekly podcast on the Close Reads podcast network when we read and discuss books. I teach high school literature and train teachers and homeschoolers to teach literature and the classics and speak and write and travel and all that kind of stuff too. And I also do counseling, and that's my personal training. I too have a master's degree in counseling. And all of that sometimes may seem diverse, and you may come across this too, or even disconnected to some people. But to me, it shares a common root. It's all very organic and connected because I believe in the power of stories. I believe in the power of narratives to heal and to form the imago Dei, or the image of God in us. Mm-hmm. I'm zealous about that. So I dwell in that space in what turns out to be a multiplicity of ways, right? Mm-hmm. So that manifests in various streams of vocation, but it comes down to that root. So when I heard you speak, I caught some of that in you as well, that same connectivity. Am I right? And can you put that into words?
Yes. You are so right. I don't know if I could put it into better words than you just used. That was very eloquent. And it captured exactly where my heart is. I feel like it's taken me maybe a good 5 or 10 years. This, just speaking about my personal journey, taken me 5 or 10 years to figure out how to communicate the diversity with the common heart. With the diversity of interests that I have, but the common heart for God, for His church, for, like, I don't know, my own healing journey. So you put all that in a big soup and you stir it around. It's like it's a beautiful, like you said, organic, like, meal. You know what I mean? Different ingredients, but man, it just, to me, it makes sense. I don't think I could say it better than you did. A diversity of interests. It's hard to explain to folks sometimes, but the heart or the root is the same. And the connection that you made with story, and I would say like with humans. So I mean, Imago Dei kind of stuff. There's, like, it seems like in your interest and in mine, like, we're kind of chasing after the same thing, you know.
Right.
Salvation or healing, ultimate healing in all of its iterations, spiritual, relational, emotional, even intellectual, like with the books and the reading and the stuff like that. So, yeah.
So let's talk about your work as a singer songwriter, which is how I originally came across your name. We listened to your albums at home. And when I was very first homeschooling my kids, many years ago, I remember we memorized the hymn "My Father's World" in your version of it. So thank you for that. I really just can't recommend your albums enough to our listeners. They're wonderful. So please check Josh's out, Josh Bales out. But there's something special about music, right? That's formative and healing to people. Like my thing's story. And I'm not a musician, but I recognize, and the ancients taught that, right? The music of the spheres, that music has this harmony to it that harmonizes the soul. Have you found that to be true? And can you kind of speculate on what that is?
Yeah, speculate is a good word, because I do think it's a mystery. I mean, there is something about song and music to connect all of this. There's something about like putting our faith into song that is very mysterious in its power to move us, like to change, even to bring about change. And so like whether you're riding in the car and you're feeling numb, you're feeling nothing, you're just doing your task for the day, and then you flip on a song on the radio or whatever, and you start to weep. I mean, that's change, that's movement in a person. So I think that's why music has the power over humanity that it does, whatever that thing is. But I would say I don't do like actual music therapy or anything. And in that way, those pieces of my life are not as connected. But certainly I'll reference songs and stuff in counseling. And people talk about, you know, people will say, oh, I put on an album to try to begin this grieving process, because this certain album brings me to tears. It helps get the feelings out. So there's that part of it. But for me, I think music and therapy connect via the creative storytelling part of it. Like creativity being one essential part of both of those things, and then the story being the other part. So even in counseling, like, I'm sure you've experienced this when you're sitting across from an individual or a couple for that matter, and they start to tell their story, there's almost a song quality to it. Like there are refrains, there are choruses. Like I've never felt loved, you know, we'll come to find out that's a part of not just this person's marriage, but their family of origin years and that kind of thing. So the verses are like little bits of stories that reflect kind of the main theme. So there's a creative like element to even how people tell their story in therapy, you know? So it's not super different for me sitting down with my guitar and trying to get out the story that's inside of me, whatever that is. I don't know. That's kind of how I connected. It's sort of, maybe it's too loose, but that's what happens.
Are you kidding? I love that. You're exactly right. I've never thought of that before, what you just said, that there are these refrains, these choruses, these stories, in a sense, that we tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you're exactly right. When you sit across from a person who is trying to find a thread of redemption in their own story and don't know how to find it, a lot of times it's because there's this refrain that the chorus, the refrain they're telling themselves, the story they're telling themselves is in many cases a lie, not intentionally, but because of the darkness that they've experienced, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of hearing the refrain, which is, I have always loved you from God, it's, I've never been loved, right? And part of counseling, part of healing is learning to tell yourself a different story.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, I feel like we could take this metaphor in a lot of directions.
Do it. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, to continue, I think my role then as a therapist is to kind of like, I'm telling them parts of the song that I hear that they may not hear, you know, which is exactly what you do in a recording. You know, you're listening, especially when you're in the recording process, you're like, some people will pick up on what the bass is doing and other people will pick up on what the guitar is doing or the piano is doing, or the violin's doing or whatever. But to be able to pull that thread out, that's different. Sort of that's just the technical term is reframing, right? Like you're just kind of reframing for them what has happened in their life. So, but all of this, like the big heading for what we're talking about now is it's creative storytelling. I mean, which is exactly what music is and exactly what counseling is, you know?
That's true. And what writing is, right? And, and I know you're a writer as well. And as I'm thinking about this in the context of teaching, and which is what I do, and you know, for example, on our on the Close Reads podcast, the other podcast I do, we just read Catcher in the Rye. And that's a dark story, and it is. It's the record of one man's distorted inner monologue, the story that he's told himself, and it's and so that he can't see those redemptive flashes in ordinary life. He doesn't have somebody, and that's the whole point of the book. He doesn't have anybody sitting across from him and saying, I hear this refrain in what you're saying. What if there's a different story? What if there's a different thread? What if God was there? Right. And I think that's one of the ways that literature can speak into that gap in between the story we tell ourselves and the true story that's coming from the creator. And music, I think, can inhabit that gap as well. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because it has this harmony to it. And I mean, I'm sure, do you have, I'm putting you on the spot here because this wasn't said before the recording, but do you have any stories come to mind? Any stories from your own personal practice or your own life about how music and storytelling have worked together to bring healing to somebody's life?
Wow. That's a question worth pondering. I mean, there are so many, I can't think of some of the stronger ones, you know, other than, referencing, like there's a song by Mary Chapin Carpenter about grief. This is one of her more recent. It's funny, like as she's getting on in years, but she's continuing to record, her songs are like getting more and more they're getting deeper and darker, I suppose. So she writes a song about grief, and I think it starts out like, grief rides quietly in the passenger seat of my car. And then the story continues with like her friendship with grief, basically, and her like coming to grips with grief, and grief is everywhere in her house, and it's like personified, you know? So I recommend that song a lot, to someone who's sort of starting the grieving journey, for whom grieving feels so weird and unnatural. And why would I give into this feeling? I need to be fighting it. And I'm like, nope, you need to put it in the passenger seat of your car. And you need to drive around town with it, and you need to get to know it, and it will become your friend, and then it will go away, you know? But, yeah, so I don't know. All people to think of, Mary Chapin, I'm not like a huge Mary Chapin Carpenter fan, but in her recent singer-songwriter albums, they've just been lovely. They're acoustic, they're, and they're deep. So
I really like that idea of welcoming the, even to personify emotions and welcome them as guests and friends instead of turning them away.
I have to make a confession. This may be so off topic, but in terms of art and counseling, art and therapy, believe it or not, and this could be so weird, I don't even know, you'll probably want to erase this from the interview, but
I'm pretty excited about whatever you're about to say right now.
I have found that more than music in therapy, like in this setting, I'm in my office right now, I tend to recommend people to watch horror films. Because in every horror film, you have some, you know, really scary thing that's trying to communicate some message, and it haunts you until you like face it. And that is, I swear, that must have been five of the six people I met with on Monday must have, that's their story. And one, whether it's death or grief or divorce or betrayal, or it doesn't matter what it is. It's like people avoiding it. I'm trying to help them face it here. You could pick of these five horror films. It's all the same theme. And I get that there's a shock factor and a darkness. And But honestly, I think that's what helps kind of awaken the, it opens you up. You're like,
Okay. I love that. Go on. Keep going.
Well, I was going to say one more thing. In terms of the shock factor of the genre of horror films, I grew up never watching horror films. I was scared to death of them. And that's a part of my journey in getting in touch with the depths of negative, hard emotions in my own life has been kind of like coming to grips with, hey, there really is darkness in the world. It is scary. And so for me, sort of the genre of horror, I'm not talking about weird, gory B horror movies. I'm talking about films. Like there's a film called The Babadook, for example. It is scary. It's frightening, but it's deeply moving. And if you're not weeping by the end of it, literally, I mean, it's very clearly a therapeutic film. So, but for me, that's been a way for Josh to get in touch with some of the darkness in my soul, you know, and sort of exercise, get it out. So the shock factor is there. I think I remember Tony Robbins, the kind of famous feel good
self-help guru from the 90s. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who's still, by the way, still going strong. But he there's a documentary and someone asked him in this documentary, why do you use so much language? Like Robbins drops the F-bomb like it's just nothing, like constantly. Mm-hmm. And he said this, he said, I only do that sort of in a therapeutic context to kind of wake people up. The shock value helps people remember. So my clients go watch The Babadook on a Friday night after we've met and they're shocked and afraid and then weeping and they never forget it, you know? I don't know if that's probably like a well-documented thing that I've just never found the resource for, but to me, that's the one form of art that is like always a part of my therapy. So I
have a couple of follow-up questions on that, but I want to get a couple of more recommendations. So you said the Babadook, and then what else? What other ones would you recommend?
Oh, man. Oh, gosh. Now I'm a little bit frightened to go on record because I don't know. These are frightening films.
Sure. And we...
I'd have to think about it. I've actually been working on an article about this. So I'm, I don't know if I'm ready to like put
it
out there.
Send it over to Forma when you're done with that. So this goes, I'm very interested in what you're saying right now, because I give several talks a year on the topic of monster stories and how every story is a monster story. That there is this, if you look in any enduring story, I'm not talking about like Raggedy Ann and SpongeBob. I'm talking about any kind of enduring children's story or adult story. It is always follows the same pattern from Pride and Prejudice to Harry Potter. Like that there is this, that the beginning of the story, there's some kind of stable society. It's either flawed or not flawed, but it's stable. And then a monster comes into the story. And the monster can be metaphorical, the monster can be literal, but some kind of darkness invades the story. And that corresponds to the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. And then a hero arises, becomes strong. Most of the time the hero starts out as weak and unable to confront the monster at the beginning of the story, right? But the hero then must be trained and made worthy of it through their own via dolorosa, their own way of suffering, their own training.
That's exactly right.
Yes, their own training in combat, whatever that combat is required. And then the hero has to die, to sacrifice themselves as they confront the monster, just as Christ did. And then the hero comes back to life in some way, whether metaphor. And I mean, you can find this in literally every story. Like I said, you can find it in Pride and Prejudice. The monster is within, right? They are they're proud and prejudiced. And because of that, they're kept from this wedding that is intended for them. And then there's also these external forces. And then Elizabeth Bennet must be made worthy to for her feast, for her wedding, right? And then, and of course you can see that in even more sharp detail in fantasy stories, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and so on and so on. And what you're talking about in a literal monster story is kind of the forcing of this narrative upon a soul that feels like it's too weak to handle it, but it isn't.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely. Yep. Okay, great. Now I don't feel so crazy. And again, you You said it way more eloquently than I did. That's exactly right.
Not at all. So don't hesitate to recommend these, with the caveat that, you know, these are not for children and et cetera, et cetera. Use your judgment and your discernment.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. But there is a sense in which the monsters are too strong unless we submit to the way of the cross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. And like I wish I could remember the name of the of this filmmaker. I honestly think it's Wes Craven. I'm not like a big Wes Craven fan or anything, but I think he went to Wheaton College.
He did go to Wheaton College.
Okay. Yeah. And there was some article a number of years ago about like a theology of horror films, and it was really good. I can't remember which publication put it out, but yeah. One, like, if listeners are interested, like, ooh, I want to try that, but I don't want to jump in the deep end and, you know, my husband comes in the room and I'm watching some weird horror film, he's going to be like, what is going on? So if I wanted to just put my toe in the water, I would say, why don't you try A Monster Calls? It's called A Monster Calls. It's really like, it's a really accessible film. Liam Neeson is like one of the voices. It's just way more accessible, but also does everything you and I just talked about. So,
okay. A Monster Calls. All right. And as you think of things, don't hesitate to just like shout them out like Tourette style. Just, I thought of another one.
yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. So I don't know how we just got to where we got, but I guess it makes sense if you've got two people who like to do lots of random stuff same place, that you would end up talking about horror films.
But. Monster stories and horror films. But Josh, you're also, along with being a horror film connoisseur, you are also an Anglican priest. But I see in your bio that you have some training. Did you come from a Reformed background?
Right. You know, I passed through Reformed land on the way to a more Anglican perspective. So,
okay, so I'm curious about that. I want to ask you about that. Forma's ecumenical. We share a common identity as a people of God, but you know, we're also always interested in people's spiritual journeys. So tell us about your work as a priest and how that came about. Tell us a little about that part of your journey.
Sure. I mean, the way I grew up in a Baptist church, we attended like kind of a Bible church mentality, like a kind of like John MacArthur type church for a number of years. And then after that, when I first started working in ministry, I was really drawn to Reformed theology and that part of the Christian family. But I just, my search took me, it kept moving me along. And it was the early church and the church fathers. And it was actually an ancient faith radio podcast, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes, absolutely.
Where I heard a guy named Bradley Nassif in Illinois, I think he made a comment that, you know, the Anglicans, he said, are the Orthodox of the West, because they have the same issues with Rome and the same issues with Protestantism that sort of keep them in their own little space. And I thought that was fascinating. I had been sneaking away to Anglican Episcopal churches for years at that point, but I was working in a Presbyterian Church of America, but we were doing mostly Anglican liturgies on Sunday morning. So, but at that point, I was cutting the grass one day. I heard him say that, and I thought, okay, well, I'm done. Like, I think Calvinism and it's the way I had learned it is done for me, because I wanted to be a part of the theology of the undivided church, the learning the Vincentian canon, as they call it, was huge for me, like that we believe what has been believed by all everywhere at all times, you know, that kind of an idea, which that gets you through like the first five centuries or something.
Right.
And then after that, things start to, but that for the version of Anglicanism that I fell in love with, because I think there are a few versions of it, was the version that said, we are Western, but we want to be with the fathers, kind of in our theology and our practice. And we acknowledge that Rome had a deep impact on England. So that's a part of our heritage too. But so then in the end, you get this wonderful mix. You get lots of Eastern theology, you get lots of Roman Western practices, and you get lots of like Protestant heart. Mm-hmm. And if I can be bold, I would say the mm-hmm. one thing I would raise the Anglican flag on is that we're in the midst of all the various parts of the Christian family tree. We're like the one group who doesn't actually keep people away from Eucharist. And maybe we do that to a fault, but we would never withhold Eucharist from a Roman Christian or an Orthodox Christian or a Protestant Christian. Baptizing the Trinity, then you can, this is the Lord's table. Whereas I think if I understand correctly, Roman Catholics, you know, are would not allow us to take, and I know I couldn't take in an Orthodox Church mm-hmm. communion. So I find that I really enjoy that. I really, that right. reflects my heart for the church, I think.
The open table.
Yeah. And not for people who've not been baptized, of sure. course, but yeah, for Christians of all parts of the, from all traditions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I love that. So I can tell from your music, and you just referenced this, and I am honing in on it, of course, and your blog, that you are a reader. Right?
Mm. You're a big reader. I try to be. Yes. I try to be, yeah.
So your songs and your blog posts, they're peppered with allusions to great thinkers, writers, poets, fathers of the church, as well as contemporary thinkers and creators, you know, Ken Myers, Andrew Peterson, Friedrich Buechner. So how does your life as a reader contribute to your vocation?
Oh, man. I it's the lifeblood, right? Mm. I mean, I feel like I'm with my friends. Mm-hmm. It's a community of thinkers. Its own community of like men and women. I'm looking at my books right now. They're on my shelf. It's like, who do I want to talk to today about therapy? You know, well, I've got some William Glasser or some Smeeds or some Irvin Yalom, or I mean, then you go down the list, you know, who do I want to talk to about music or about culture or something? I've got all my Colson Center books right in front of me as well. Jeremy Begbie on beauty and music. You know, I mean, these are, right. Isn't it like a conversation?
Same, yes. So I
was saying, I think right when I got cut off, I was saying that I've, to be honest with you, I'm not a good reader. I've never felt like a strong reader. And the first time that reading really took off for me, I was made to read growing up, I was homeschooled for a time. And so we had to read like a certain number of pages a week, just every week. It could be anything at our kind of grade level, but we were made to read, and I did not like it at all. It wasn't really until college and that I was finally reading stuff that actually captured my imagination, which was the theology part. So I feel like I've been a little bit stunted in my growth as a reader after that, because I've kind of stuck to what I know. And what I know I can get through and enjoy. But I've always been drawn to fiction. I've always wanted to read fiction. I've always wanted to read novels and stories. And I've very much struggled with that. So I don't know if that's my ADD or what. But so recently I've like started trying to learn how to read fiction better. And I'm literally like working my way through books that probably most people read when they were younger. This past summer, so right now I'm attempting the biggie, one of the biggies, Anna Karenina.
Awesome.
And I'm finding it's not as hard as I was afraid it was going to be. Like, I'm actually into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's not a chore at all. Now I'm like, I'm over the hump. I'm way into it. I can't wait to open it when I put the girls down. And, but as early as this summer, I literally read The Yearling for the first time in my life.
And did you cry? Everybody cries
gosh.
When they read that book. That
absolutely.
Is a book. That is like the masculine soul, that book is.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I figured kind of the ending of the story, but not as it hit me was, yeah, like more what you're saying. It wasn't just you know, a pet story. It was about the masculine soul. So, also, you know, it's the setting is here in Florida. And so that was really interesting to me too. Like, oh, I live really close to like where this kind of happened, you know, or where the setting was. So yeah, I'm learning. I feel like I'm a new fiction reader. So that's kind of my story right now with reading. If I can confess that, I feel like everyone else I know is a better reader than me. So I'm working at it.
So I feel like everybody I know is a better reader than me too. And I'm an avid reader. Okay. And, but I think what you're saying is probably really, really encouraging to lots of parents who are listening in and saying, my kids, I want them to be readers because it's something I love.
Yeah.
And it just hasn't caught on. They haven't taken off on that yet. So it's the planting of seeds. That's what parenting is. That's what therapy is. Even as a musician, people listen to your songs sometimes, I'm sure, and say, oh, that was nice. And then later they'll remember something that hits them at a time when they need it. So I think that's many of our journeys with reading as well. But you, I'm interested in this. You, in your talk in Colorado Springs, you referenced some very early work from the church fathers, and your eyes lit up when you read the quote. I noticed it right away. And the church fathers, as those of us who I'm reading the church fathers for the first time as an adult as well. And they are, I'm learning, absolutely not dry academics, but vibrant, spiritually healthy men who saw things we often don't see about an integrated spiritual life.
Integrated, that's it, yeah.
Yes, so tell me about your reading of the Church Fathers. What have you found, and how does that impact your work?
Well, I think my introduction to the Church Fathers was, sad to say, and this is I'll just make the point and not comment on it, but in my studies at Reformed Theological Seminary, which I have a lot of friends there, we did not read a lot of the Church Fathers.
I was an adult either.
From what I know now, that just so surprises me. And I dare say, I think it's like, it's a weakness of Reformed, graduate education. That's probably not true for everybody. Maybe it was just my classes or my professors or whatever, but we did not read the Church Fathers. And so, it was after that, it was on the way into moving from a more Protestant, kind of church expression to a more Catholic, universal church, liturgical church, sacramental church. The Church Fathers greased the tracks for me. When I'm reading folks from the English Reformation, not the Continental Reformation, but like the English Reformers, who were kind of this weird blend of Catholic and Protestant, they're quoting Church Fathers left and right. So you combine that for me with the Ancient Faith Radio podcast, all of them, I digested a few years ago. I just went through every possible Eastern Orthodox podcast I could find. And the main reason was, one, I'd never been exposed to any kind of Eastern theology. And two, I couldn't believe that this was basically, I feel like I was getting an up close and personal understanding of what some of the early church fathers taught explicitly, like from their writings directly, not reinterpreted through the Reformation, but as they wrote it. You know, it's like, this is insane. I couldn't believe it. Recently when Hank Hanegraaff made his big, isn't that his name?
He made his big, that's right, the Bible Answer Man.
Mm-hmm. I mean, his story was, he went all the way, right? He went all the way into Eastern Orthodoxy, but that's what kind of ripped me out of my Protestant context was the Church Fathers. And I got the Church Fathers through the current podcast boom in the Eastern Orthodox Church of America. So, I mean, that's just my story. So SVS Press, you know, has all these
all these church father books that I just started asking for them for Christmas, St. Vladimir's Press. And so that's what I started reading. Mm. I'm just remembering that one of my professors in seminary at Reformed Theological Seminary has also made this journey from Reformed parts of the church into the Anglican church right before I did. He's actually now my boss at this cathedral. Huh. And he was my professor, now he's my boss. And he made the same sort of journey, and he was the one professor who did assign church fathers. And we read On the Sacraments by
Basil the Great, or is that Athanasius?
Starts with a C.
Cyril.
Saint Cyril of Jerusalem.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was the book we read. Of course, that's a wildly different view of the sacraments than you would find in Protestant churches. So,
sure.
Yeah. So since then, I just gained a respect that I did not have for the first, what, 4 or 5 centuries of the church. I didn't even know that I could read the fathers and understand them. But if you look at like Athanasius on the Incarnation, that's like a wonderful short every year at Christmas read, you know, for like, mm-hmm. that could be, it's so accessible. It's so accessible. It's fascinating. And one of the other things about the church fathers that has really inspired me is in the American expression of Anglicanism, which is called the Episcopal Church. It has sort of, it's a mainline denomination, and it's basically gone just wildly liberal. I mean, if we're going to use words liberal and conservative, it is what most people would think of as liberal theology. You know, now that's not my expression of theology. That's not actually my church's expression of Anglicanism. Mm-hmm. But that's on the whole, that's where that denomination is. So while the denomination as a whole is sort of drifting liberal, there are a lot of folks. I don't want to just say it's all millennials, but I feel like there are a lot of millennials who grew up in the very conservative, maybe even like a fundamentalist kind of background that are, as you probably heard on social media and other Christian media outlets, like they're jumping ship, right? They're leaving Christianity. Mm-hmm. Like Josh Harris, or the two guys in Charlotte, North Carolina, I think that have a big podcast, Rhett and someone, I can't remember his name, but they're all jumping ship. What I found out in reading the Church Fathers is that a lot of the views that people think are brand new or like ultra liberal or something is actually like way within the stream of broad orthodoxy throughout the centuries. Like right now, everyone's talking about David Bentley Hart's book on hell.
That all shall be saved. Right?
Yeah,
many of the church fathers were universalists and believed that all would be saved. Yeah.
Like the way that everyone uses the word universalist may not be the same, but yeah, that's a good example. Like, for example, a number of years ago when Rob Bell wrote his book and everyone freaked out, what I wish someone could have told Rob Bell is, hey man, did you know that there were a bunch of authors in the first 5 centuries of the church that you could read who might actually offer you an option that is
right.
still within this stream of orthodoxy, and you don't have to pretend to be this like rogue, rebellious, let's lead everyone out of the church. Like, why don't you submit to the church and find within the fathers one of the views? Because that's what I find freedom. I find mm-hmm. theological freedom and orthodoxy at the same time in the fathers. And I just think for people, especially for people who grew up fundamentalists that are feeling the need to jump the ship right now, once they find out that their 15 to 1800s view of inerrancy or whatever, however you want to talk about the scripture, is not going to hold up, and now they're like, oh, it's all fake, you know? No, you right. why don't you look at the fathers and how they talked about scripture, and there are different ways to think about what it means that scriptures are completely true and also written by humans. So
absolutely.
Maybe
no,
this
it's
is
great.
A rant, but.
No, it's not a rant. It's really important because we're talking about people within some of the greatest minds in history, within the first centuries of the faith. They were closer to the apostles than we are. And that's really important to remember. We are not claiming, I don't hear you claiming that they are inerrant, right? That they are, but that they are geniuses who are very close to the original timing of the founding of the faith and involved in the founding of the faith. And that's really important. And then also to point out that the reformers themselves were eagerly claimed the church fathers. Calvin spent so much time referencing the fathers and the institutes. Anybody who reads the institutes knows that. So we're not talking even within the magisterial reformation. There was an understanding of the importance of these authors and these writers.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They were not rejecting the fathers. They were claiming them as their own. And so even as we differ in within the ecumenical Christian faith, to your point, this is the knowledge of the men who were part of the founding of the faith, part of the church councils, who were establishing the doctrines of the Trinity and of the Holy Scriptures and of the Incarnation. They have something to offer modern Christians, no matter where we stand theologically. And I hear in what you're saying an invitation to be a part of that foundation of the faith.
Yes, that's absolute. That's it. It's like what we're saying now is the church fathers become kind of a point of unity, like a point of reference for Catholicity across the church, you know? So yeah, I just think there's so much to talking about the early church fathers, and reading them, and hearing them discussed on those podcasts was just a deep, deep part of my journey. Like it made me want to be a part of the big, big stream of the Christian church, not like a little, I don't know, maybe how you'd say it, like a ghettoed kind of a theological ghetto. You know, I want to be a part of the big stream. So
I love that. I felt that too. That's been a big part of my journey. Thank you for putting that into words. So Josh, we have just a few more minutes left, and this might seem a bit unusual, but I do want to ask you to speak to what's going on in the culture right now. This is a big moment in the United States, and you and I were talking offline before we hit record about COVID, about the threat of the coronavirus. And right now we're in the throes of a national crisis, which is producing anxiety for a lot of people. Can you speak to people struggling with fear or loneliness or anxiety right now?
Absolutely. First of all, let me just speak as if kind of how I'm talking to myself right now. We're humans, and we're going through a tragedy where our humanity, the weakness of our humanity, is being exposed, you know, our frailty. And the tendency is to like despise that. Not in a healthy theological way, but like to resist it. And that's not going to work. Like, I mean, at some point, whether it's this or something else, like death will win the day for our current human selves. So, this is where by the way, the existentialist part of the psychological family are really helpful. You know, they just say like, you've got to wrestle with your fear of death. So we could talk about whether it's the coronavirus or terrorism or whatever. It's all the same. It's a fear of death.
Right.
And so, you know, we were talking about earlier about befriending our sorrow. And I think now would be a time to befriend our fear and our anxiety, and let it lead us, but not let it dominate us. Because that's the coronavirus isn't all there is. Death is not all there is in the world. So that would be too narrow to let the reality of the coronavirus, the reality of our feeble human bodies, the reality of death, to let that dominate would be not a realistic assessment of all there is in the world, you know. But on the other hand, to resist it, pretend it's not there, pretend we're not afraid, that would be like an equal mistake. So the first healthy thing we can do is feel our emotions. It's like second grade stuff that probably most of us did not get, including me, that I learned when I was, 25 or something. Oh, it's okay to feel afraid.
Right.
And if I could be so bold, I would say, to talk to yourself and don't feel weird about it. Tell yourself what any good parent would tell a scared child. So in a sense, kind of be your own mom and dad. Hey, Josh, you know, this is scary. Everything's shutting down in your city. People are freaking out. You do have the chance of getting sick. But I want you to know that, God is in charge, and I'm going to help you do healthy things with your fear. I'm going to help you do healthy things with your anxiety. That's the second thing. If you don't befriend your fear and anxiety, it's going to not only take over, but you're going to end up it's going to come out sideways, you know, through addictions or through, I don't know, irritability. You're going to push people away that you actually need when you're at home quarantined or whatever it is. So befriend your emotion, validate it, don't judge it, don't let it overtake you either, since Jesus is king and not your fear, right? And then I would say, it's funny, in such an individualistic society, when all of our bodies fail us at the same time because of this, common virus, it's like you can't deny anymore the reality of community, that we are in a community, that we're a part of a whole. Isn't that funny? Liturgical and sacramental churches right now, we are already in touch with the idea of common religion, common prayer, common approaches to God, what we all share in common. We don't necessarily think of prayer as an individual sport, you know?
Right.
And so here you have In our circles in America, we have a bunch of individualistic kind of Christian mentalities, and they're up against a common virus. It's like, that doesn't work. So now common prayer and common worship is more important than ever, right? Because we're battling a common enemy. So community is a part of this. We've got self-care, befriend your fear, do things in common, and in a healthy way, of course, especially as churches are closing down, but be with family, pray with family, be with friends, pray with friends. I don't know if I can pull off both of those things over the next 8 weeks, I will feel like even as a therapist, I'm on the right track. I think those things are hard to do.
Yes. No, that's wisdom. Thank you. So just a quick little question. What are you reading right now? We're all stuck at home reading. What are you reading right now?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Anna Karenina. So that's my big project at home. I'm also reading, George Weigel's Letters to a Young Catholic, I think, Letter to a Young Catholic. It's really interesting. It's short, it's super accessible, and it's a kind of in story form, so it's wonderful. Okay. I recently finished Wendell Berry stuff, and that for me was the first time I'd read his fiction work, like Jabber Crow and Hannah Coulter. Yeah.
They're excellent. We're big fans of Wendell Berry over at Forma.
I enjoy those stories very much. Yep. I'm sure there's other stuff. You know, one thing we talked about earlier was work, and I meant to reference a book that I thought that we would get to it, but the book that helped me put some work things together that would be something to read in the next few weeks of quarantine, perhaps, would be Thomas More's A Life at Work.
Okay.
Thomas More, not the old Thomas More, but he's a...
The At new Thomas point, More, the one who is not assassinated or murdered by Henry VIII.
That's exactly correct. Right. And this guy is for our listeners, in terms of Orthodox Christianity, I think there would probably at this point be some issues with his orthodoxy. Maybe we would all agree if in terms of just classic statements of faith. But There's a lot to be gained from his writing and how he thinks about work. And he also wrote a book called The Reenchantment of Everyday Life. And that's a really interesting read too.
This is good. I'm making a list.
Yeah.
I haven't read either of those. So
I think you would, just based on your, how you talk about your work and your life, I think you would really get a kick out of his book on work. So
he argues
for a multiplicity of work, not just choosing one thing. He thinks that's like a modern sort of error.
I agree. I think he's right.
Yes.
That's good. I'd love to read that. What about work right now? Are you working on any projects that we should know about? And what are you most excited about that you're working on right now?
Oh man, I'm working on family. I'm working on raising my daughters. I don't know.
Good for you.
I don't know how well I'm doing at that. I mean, you know, as an artist, musician, there's a sadness in not being able to just spend days writing and recording. I mean, there's a loss there, but I think it's for a much better cause. So, and I hope that in the days to come, I get to return to that. I've got songs that are percolating, and I'm just trying to put them on paper as we go. So I don't know when, but I have a feeling that in the next 9 months or so, there will be some windows of time as my 1-year-old gets a little bit older, that I can spend a weekend and get some of these songs on tape. And then that will be the next project. I do know that I want to do another singer-songwriter project. So I don't think I'm going to be doing a hymns thing, but I've got some new songs along the lines of that horror film conversation that we had. So I want to get some dark songs out there.
I will eagerly anticipate that.
Okay. Okay.
All
good.
Right. For our Forma listeners, how can they find you, Josh?
Yes. So you can find me just at my website, joshbells.com. And I try to keep it as up to date as possible. And it's got where I'm playing the different conferences or articles that I'm writing for Colson Center or sermons that I'm giving at church. So I try to just get my content out there.
Great. All right. Well, go ahead and find that for my listeners. I'm telling you, it is a treasure trove. So Josh, thank you for joining us on the Forma podcast, on the Circe podcast network. This was such a good conversation. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, but I hope that it can bless people. So thank you so much.
Absolutely, Heidi. Thank you so much for having me and just your kind questions and your encouragement of my own work. It really does mean a lot. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, and thank you to our listeners. If you like what you hear, please follow us, subscribe, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to Forma Journal as well. We are busily working on the spring issue, and we've got some great reviews and articles and original poetry like we always have. So we will catch you next time with more contemplations on the intersection of classical thought and contemporary culture. I'm Heidi White for the Circe Podcast Network. We'll see you next time.